Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free. Or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
And I come back and accused of killing a guy called Kenneth Lenihan, who was a member of the EVF in Donegal Pass, and shooting three of his companions or his colleagues. I don't find it hard to admit. No, I was a bigot. It's hard or as easy to admit that I was an IRA gunman, that I was an IRA killer. I mean, Freddie Scabatici got me over to the Strand and the CFOs came over, briefed me, told me what to expect, then came around later to another CFOs, got me off to the dock. But I ended up getting caught. I know the night that they captured me, the first night they said, we've got the gunman.
Anthony, you're very welcome to the No Edit podcast.
Delighted to be here and grateful for the opportunity.
The first question I'm going to ask you as a lifelong Republican is your thoughts on United Ireland. Any closer, any further?
Well, as a 19th century art critic used to say of Berlin, it's always in the process of becoming and never in the state of being. And this seems very much the same to me in relation to a United Ireland. I don't think we're certainly no closer as a result of anything the IRA did. If we are, it's as a result of the instability created by Brexit. But at the end of the day, I think that the consent principle, as applied in the North, is not going to result in a majority of people for the long-term foreseeable future that's going to change the constitutional position. I have stated for many years that no one who was ever in the Provisional IRA will ever live to see United Ireland. No one who fought in the ranks of the Provisional IRA will ever live to see what they fought for.
Do you find that hard to say, Anthony? Because at one time you were in the Provisional IRA and I'm sure you believed that you would see a United Ireland in your lifetime.
Well, I did believe I would see a United Ireland in my lifetime. I mean, who would get on a rocket to go to the moon if they were told they were never going to reach it? That somebody would reach, and somebody's, one of your children conceived and born on the moon might reach it, but I wouldn't get on that rocket. I look back at the situation and I don't, it's easy for me to say actually because I'm trying to describe it for what it is. It's not joyful for me to say, but at the same time, it's not sad. I think it's a fact that I have just come to terms with over the years. And I have certain views on the IRA's war that I didn't have at the time I was part of it. And so the absence of a United Ireland or the unviability of United Ireland in the near future doesn't really annoy me. I think the older you get, the emphasis in life changes. And when I look at my children and stuff and I look at the young population, I'm tempted to always ask, I do ask the question, it's not that I'm tempted. And that question is, I mean, what would we prefer to be under British rule with the state of the world National Health Service or to be under Irish rule where we died like medieval peasants? because we had no health service? The answer's quite simple. I prefer to be under British rule. It's about what's good for people. I think as Owen McNeill, not a popular figure in republicanism, once said, there's no kissing the Houlihan or he's calling us, it's a ghost. You know, the real people, real world, will have to do real things.
So what is your thoughts on Brexit, Anthony? I mean, many people, when this all started, had visioned that this was the way it was going to go, that it would weaken the union. What were your thoughts on it at the start and what are they now?
Well, firstly, I didn't have thoughts on it that it would weaken the union because I never thought it was going to come about. It seems such a ridiculous proposal that I didn't think it was possible. When it did come about, I didn't take the view that it would weaken the union. I thought there was a rush of blood to the head on parts of many people in the media, and there was a lot of alarmism going on that United Ireland's just around the corner. But I thought when the dust has settled, we'd find out what we've known anyway, that a United Ireland will come, not as a result of Brexit, but only as a result of what the majority of people in the North think, and of a majority of people in the North decide that there will be a United Ireland. At the moment, I don't see that majority having come into place. And so I don't think that there will be United Ireland. And I do suspect that at some point they will reframe and subvert the 50+1 clause in the Good Friday Agreement, and they will work towards creating a weighted majority, that in order for constitutional change to come about, you're going to have 60% voting in favour. So I think all these things are out there. And I would like to see United Ireland. I won't. And I don't think it's in the near future. I don't foresee it happening within the next 30 years. No matter what Mary Lou says, it's all rhetoric, because at the end of the day, they get into government, they'll do what all parties do in government. And what would mean the there's all parties, the government in any society has to perform a structural function. And Sinn Féin will do the exact same. And that structural function does not require the end of partition.
Growing up in the North in 1957, the year you were born, before the Troubles, tell me what that was like.
Well, I remember when I was born, my parents moved very shortly after I was born to South Belfast. I think they first moved to University Street and then to the first family home that I remember, which was in Baggot Street, 23 Baggot Street. When we moved in, I have no memory of it, but my father and mother were telling me about we were the only Catholics in the street. By the time we moved out of it, everybody in the street was Catholic. We were one of the only family, and on the 11th of July or 12th of July, we had an X put on our door, daubed on our door. Now, my memory of growing up was that our Protestant neighbours were very kind people. They were never, I was probably more of a devil to them than they ever were to me. They were very nice. There was a guy at the corner of the street, used to be he was an orange man called Alex MacDonald. He lived in McClure Street, just around the corner from us. And he didn't run a furniture business, but he drove a lorry for a furniture business. And he went at Easter and stuff when I was off work, he would get me to come with him in the lorry and help him out with all the lifting the furniture and stuff. And he paid me £3 for 3 days and £1 a day. I mean, it was good then, you know, for the amount of stuff that I'd done, and I love getting out with him. And I remember one night, I think it was 1970, going into my dad, seeing Alex stand at the top of the street with a uniform on. I came in and I said to my dad, Daddy, Alec MacDonald's a peeler, and he says he's not, he's a B special. I didn't know what a B special was, you know. But even though he was a B special, he never, ever, nor did his son, who I was very friendly with, Drew, never once did they show one sign of sectarian hostility. And I was a kid, I was a Catholic kid that he brought out, you know, on doing the job. So It was interesting. They used to burn a bonfire at the top of our street. A guy called Lenny Caldwell. He was a teenager. And I always remember my mother used to say, Lenny Caldwell will be burning the bonfire. Now, we would go up there and watch it and stuff, and they never gave us any hassle. There was nothing. And over the course of years, the demographic composition of the Lower Omer Road began to change. I mean, I remember the guy called Bobby Mitchell. He had a son called Roy, and he had another son whose name I forget. Paul, I think it was. And Bobby used to take us to Linfield matches, and he had the two sons signed up as card-carrying members of the Shankill Tartan. And then when I was in jail in 1982, I think January 1982, Bobby and his son Roy were shot dead in an internal UDA feud over in Castlereagh or Craigah or Braniel, that part of the neck of the woods. I remember feeling sorry for him, thinking, you know, yeah, he was a sort of a decent stadium, but very, very staunch, fervent loyalist. But I remember thinking Roy down at 21, Bobby down, and you know, saying, strangely enough, when I was brought out to Castlereagh one time for one of them Supercross trials, and we're just sitting there, and the cops were interrogating us, and this time we were talking to them, just chatting away, and we're talking about Bobby getting killed, and one of the cops had said, yeah, it was a pretty nasty one, you know, but this is what happens when you get involved in these things.
It sounds like that had a big impact on you, Anthony. And, I mean, what's your earliest memories of the Troubles breaking out?
Well, I remember the Troubles breaking out very well because it was an exciting time. And I remember going up on the morning of after the burnings on the Falls Road. I remember going up with three other kids to the Falls Road and going up the street, Conway Street, I think it was. And that smell of burning furniture that had been doused by water, firemen, I can still feel that. I can still sense that in my nostrils each time I talk it. It's a peculiar, pungent odour. And we went up, and I remember we came back with this thing somebody found what looked like a tin of something. And there seemed to be like what looked to us like the end. Well, we were very young, but it looked to us like the end of a pump. When you, the only attachment that you put into the ball or you put into your bag. Well, there was this scene of thing. But anyway, we were all sitting in the railway playing with it, and bang, an unmerciful bang. And I remember feeling the getting hot charge or something in my legs and my hands, very, very minor, and this ringing in my ears and the fours, but we thought no more of it. I think what had happened, it was a detonator, and wow. I don't know if it was a bomb or anything, but we certainly left. We could have all been killed or blinded or stuff. And I remember that morning very, very well, and I remember when it happened, I went round. My dad used to send me around to get the Irish News around in my cracking shop in the front of the Lower Omer Road, and I had read it on the way back that four people had been shot dead, and I said to my dad, when do you think a shooting will start? And he says, nah, shortly enough. And I says, it already has, there's four people dead. And he daved to get the paper from me. So if they have memories, but if memories of growing up, see, I was a Glentoran supporter, as you can see. And when I as a Glentoran supporter, there were a unionist part of the city. They came from, they were, their ground, the Oval, was in the heart of East Belfast, just off D Street, the Lower Newton Arch Road. So we used to go over there to their games until we got beat up one day, myself and a friend. I remember we used to love the bonfires, and we used to collect for them and burn the bonfires for the 12th. And I remember Paddy Callaghan's wife saying, why don't you just collect for the 15th instead of collecting for the 12th? But we didn't know. We had no real sort of idea. I mean, it seemed to us to be a cultural thing. And then we would go up and watch them, the bands, and we loved the noisy bands, which would be today known as the Blood and Thunder or the Kick the Pope bands. They were the best. So there was that sort of environment growing up, but over the course of time, maybe I have Protestant friends and stuff then, over the course of time it all changed, you know, Protestants moved out, British Army come on the streets. First were welcome, then they were hated.
So you grew up, no sectarianism, and then the Troubles happened, and did it feel like it kind of went away overnight, that harmony?
No, well, it wasn't exactly harmony. I'll tell you why. I had experiences probably that shaped my perspective. When I was young, and used to stay with my grandma in my granny in Glenmacken Street, which is the last street in the village area of Belfast, South Belfast, before you reach the M1 and the Blackwater River. And I remember one time getting beat up by kids from Bimborb Street, which was, next street was Lochiel Street, Glenmacken, Lochiel, Bimborb, Tavana. They were from Bimborb Street, and they kept getting beat up and called a Teague and a Fenian bastard and stuff. And that made me think. And then I was getting beat up by Protestant kids and from Sandy Row in the railway lane. Myself and David Young went down one time. And David Young was my Protestant friend, and they only beat me up. So these things began to, shape my attitude. And I thought for some reason that people who were Protestants, had a potential to do me harm. And I would have grown up resentful and wanted to get my own back on them. And then at school, I was always trouble maker anyway at school. But at school, I remember getting attacked on a bus by them one time to get on a bus. But I funny enough, that was a day I had brought a bag full of bricks onto the bus, because what we were going to do, we were going to drop them on a bus shelter as the bus stopped, just to frighten everybody. Pure and utter vandalism, not to break the bus shelter, but to just frighten everybody for the laugh. And I had the bricks. So when they came up and beat me up, as they were going down the stairs, I'm down off them with the bricks and I battered them. These were men. They battered them with bricks down them stairs. They got more damage than I did, and they jumped off the bus. But I remember getting a different bus to school off that. That was a 20, and it was a 76 killing the Herc, and after that I got the 20 Tully Carnet to avoid them.
What age were you then, Anthony?
I had been 12.
So did you have a hatred for Protestants, or was it a fear?
I think it was a fear, and quickly, you can very quickly hate what you fear. What makes you frightened and nervous, you will grow to hate. And I developed what I would say over the years, I became a proper little sectarian bigot. I did have a hatred and a fear.
Well, and do you find that hard to admit? And did you find it hard to come to the realisation that you were a bigot?
Well, I think I came to the realisation that I was a bigot after I'd stopped being a bigot. I don't find it hard to admit, no, I was a bigot. It's hard or as easy to admit that I was an IRA gunman, that I was an IRA killer. It's what happened. I did come to the realization that I had been a bigot in my young days. And the strange thing is, I remember walking around the jail in 1975. I was in jail in 1975 in McGilligan. And myself and another guy from an IRA leader from Belfast, and he said to me, "Well, what are you going to do when you get out?" And he says, "I'm going to hit the orange men. I'm going to hit them. I'm going to hit them sore." And he said to me, "So you're going to go after Orange?" There's no attempt to dissuade me from it or anything. So, that was my attitude when I got out. And I had a sectarian attitude. And I remember coming back in and Brent Hughes saying to me, not a good attitude to have, not a good attitude. And then at what point does it leave you? I don't know. It's easy to say. But, you're meeting sort of screws and stuff, and some of the two most decent screws that I met in the jail, one was both were ex-cops and they were Protestants, And this one called Freddie Chambers used to, you know, 1976, if I hadn't got books, Freddie would say, what books are you looking for? And I'd say, well, Sven Hassel's, and that's what I was reading at the time, Sven Hassel's, I haven't got maybe SS General, or I haven't got a Semi Gestapo. Freddie bring them in from home, you know. And you knew that these guys were good, decent people, but I mean, these, you can have an idea of a person being decent, but from he's from a very indecent community. That's the way you think, and you get sort of separated these in your mind. I know by, I mean, after I got out of prison, I know that I had very, very little. I had no sectarian animosity, certainly, towards Protestants. I had been hostile to the UDA and the UVF. But I mean, it met some of these guys in the workout scheme. It met John White, who was the UFF guy who was convicted of killing Senator Paddy Wilson and Aaron Andrews. And John White had a vicious reputation. I remember meeting him in the jail when they were in the workout. I mean, I got on with him. They were friendly enough. I met others that I was very friendly with. Guy Jordy McMappin from Rathcoole, me and him were thick as thieves. Jordy used to come in and he'd bring joints in. I would sit and smoke a joint in his cell and talk football, talk nonsense. Others who were, you know, Wesley, I forget his second name, he died a couple of years ago. Wesley, UVF prisoner. He was a Crusaders fan, as a Glentoran fan. So me and him would talk soccer. You know, like you'd meet these guys. And so when I get out just in front of them, they were staging it. I remember getting a bottle of vodka and coming down and meeting them all at the bus station for they were going back, the Ulster bus station down in Glengall Street. I'm going over and seeing John Waite and saying, well, hi, how are you? Well, John, there's a bottle of vodka for the boys, you know, and giving it to him and him saying thanks. And then he went up and shared it out with them all. I mean, he wasn't a packet of it, so.
How were you able to have that trust, Anthony? Because as we know, during the Troubles, I mean, people were being killed, I mean, every week. And, you know, you were mortal enemies.
Well, we were, but we were also prisoners, and we were out on the workout scheme. We'd all serve life sentences. There was no risk to me going to Glengall Street to give him a bottle of vodka. I met them all, shook hands with them all. I mean, Republicans and loyalists, and it just threw them in this bottle of vodka. I remember one time, one of them that I was working out with, I happened to be in Stewart's before it became Tesco's at the bottom of the Donegal Road, right beside the M1, and one of the loyalist lifers was in with his wife, Shabban, and I says, you're taking a bit of a chance. He says, actually, I won't be too long until I'm out. And he says, if I was you, I just wouldn't shop here. I was friendly with him. I wasn't threatening him. I was just saying to him, be careful. Because they're just across the street in the park center, UDR man had been marched out one time and shot dead. There I went and lifted him. And so I just said that guy, you know, from dangerous, you know. And like we used to come home. I remember us driving home and dropping. We had to drop a guy called Jimmy Campbell up at his house in, I think it was Ballysill. There's me, Tommy McKerney, and somebody else, and we dropped him there. And Jimmy Campbell was in for having carried out the McGurk's Bar pub bombing. So it was that sort of relationship that could have, you know, that you did have with them. You could be friendly with them. And I remember meeting them in town, a guy we had known was Sammy Schuster. Was a loyalist, and Sammy had died a year after he got out, but just, you know, heart attack, but just before he had seen him one time in town, I think he was with his wife, and stopped me, shook hands, and I was slagging him and bantering him at the very bottom of Castle Street, you know. So we could have had friendship with them. I mean, one of the people who I developed a very close friendship with over the years was, I don't see him now, like, but it was Davy Adams. He was involved in UDA talks and stuff, and I met Davy at conferences, and me and him got on like a house on fire. But I always found, I mean, I could, you know, there was a degree of trust, because a number of years ago when Billy Mitchell was still alive, now it's a way, because Billy Mitchell died in 2005, 2006. Billy Mitchell took myself and another Republican into the one of the estates in Antrim. I think it was the Stiles estate. It was the Loyalist estate, and I might have just mixed up the name, but I think it's the Stiles estate, in the community centre, to meet with the leadership of the UVF to try and mediate, because there was tension, interface tension. I mean, we went in, we caught him and killed, but we took absolute trust that we wouldn't. We had trust in Billy Mitchell.
Wow.
I'd also served on the magazine board of editors, along with Billy Mitchell, of the Other View. So me would develop this trust. You know, I remember when my child was born, I took her over to see Billy Mitchell and all, and their wee office at the corner of Link Centre, I think it was called, at the corner of the York Road, just up from York Gate. And they're all fussed and everything over, and Billy's wife was there. And at my wedding, myself and Carrie's wedding, somebody says, "This is the strangest wedding ever. There you have the UVF sitting, Billy Mitchell, and you have the real IRA, Marion Price." She's doing best woman. And, you know, like, it was a sort of, it's just the way we developed over the years. And now I think I can genuinely say that I do not have one sectarian thought in my head. Not one.
Take me back to your a teenage boy, and you start thinking about republicanism.
Sometimes I wonder if you think about republicanism or if you drink republicanism. It's just something that you absorb. I didn't grow up in a particularly republican environment. My mother or father weren't republicans as such. I remember one of the early films I watched was Shake Hands with the Devil, James Cagney. I had an interest in the IRA because it seemed romantic and like that. But I know from early on that I was starting to develop a strong hostility to the British Army and the RUC. They were attacking people. And particularly, we would watch, like, even though we turned against them by this stage, but in the late 70, early 1971, we used to watch the riots on TV in Derry. And the Derry riders seemed the best riders in the world because they were up close and personal. This was hand-to-hand fighting, and we thought it was really brave and really courageous. And then when, I mean, the British shot Desmond Beattie and a guy called Cusack in Derry in 71, it infuriated us. And so then we would take part in riots. I remember in the morning of the night before internment, riding in Leeson Street in the Grosvenor Road, and the day after, all day internment, riding in the Grosvenor Road, the Falls Road, barricades. We fought all day with the British. They threatened to shoot us dead at one point. They took out a loudhailer and said if we weren't off the streets within 60 seconds, he'd order his troops to fire. And we rained a ton of battles down on top of them. And the following night, over at the English's Bakery, the gun battle, the rats, and all. So, I mean, like, you were gravitating towards it. I had seen why were people like me from the type of community that I'm from that go to the same type of school, that goes to the same type of church, supports the same type of football teams. Even when I'm thinking of Celtic and Stirling, even though I supported Glentoran, I'd have been the traitor. Why are they even attacked by the state? So I gravitated into armed republicanism quite easily.
Can you talk about how you got involved with the IRA?
Well, I mean, I was in the Fianna very early on, the official Fianna. It was the only Fianna in our area. And when I left it, I was involved in riding and stuff and running for the IRA that asked you to do something. And when I turned 16, and then we were doing a lot of sort of, I mean, we had friends who were in the IRA, friends who had been in the official funeral with us were now in the IRA, and they were out carrying out the operations and, you know, doing things, and it would say, could you keep a watch or could you go and see somebody or could you deliver a message? And then when we did this, we were, three of us were on team. They asked us, would we like to join? This is towards the end of 1973. And we said, I was the only one who ended up joining. We all said yes at the start, but I sort of stayed the course. So I was a fully fledged member of the IRA when I was 16.
And it wasn't that long after that that he carried out the murder that would see you jailed for life?
Well, it was about, I suppose, the dead term, 3 years, not long. But at that age, 3 years was a long time. Let me see. I went into prison in April 1974. And I went into prison. They had raided my house and had found something about detail about a bombing run. They arrested me. I went on the run. They arrested me. I mean, right on the run, I had worked with Freddy Scapatici, strangely enough, in the markets. And he had eventually got me down to Dundalk, but I came back up because I was fed up with it. You mean Freddy Scapatici got me over to the Strand and the safe house, came over, briefed me, told me what to expect, then came around later to another safe house, got me off to the dock. But I ended up getting caught. And I remember them Brits used to send the people, he's a gunman, he'd be shot in sight. And I kept getting told, I didn't believe it was to be shot in sight, but they kept saying it anyway. I know the night that they captured me, the first night they said, we've got the gunman. But they sort of, 2 days later, I was out because he remanded me to St. Patrick's home, and I was out of it that quickly. By the time the IRA came up to spring me, I was already in Turf Lodge. So I was back doing IRA activity, ended up in jail, 16. They remanded to Crumlin Road Jail and got a 2-year sentence. Got out at the end of 1975, in November 1975, the 5th of November, and came back in the 27th of February. And I came back in accused of killing a guy called Kenneth Lenehan, who was a member of the EVF in Donegal Pass, and shooting three of his companions or his colleagues. I got a life sentence of 25-year recommendation in jail. I remember when the judge gave me the sentence, I laughed at him, and I got called in the Belfast Telegraph laughing killer, jail for life. It was teenage bravado, you know. Weren't laughing at the family or anything. Although I suppose at the day, back in the day, I could have laughed at them as easily, but I wasn't thinking them at the time. I was just laughing at the judge and treating the judge with sort of teenage arrogance, teenage contempt.
And Kenneth Lenehan was a 35-year-old doorman who was shot dead as he worked outside Victor's Bar, which was close to the Loyalist Donegal Pass, and not too far from where you were living.
Well, I actually lived in Twinburg, but the best stage. But right. I was involved with the IRA in South Belfast. I was I get described by the Sunday Times as a South Belfast IRA commander, which is sort of highfalutin jargon for being the OC of the Lower Armour Road. Yeah, that's right. Yeah. What they said there.
You spoke about being in court and laughing at the judge. And did you see Kenneth Lenehan's family?
I seen his father one time coming up. His father came up to give evidence. The only evidence he gave was of being he identified his son, and he gave that evidence. And he went up and into the box and then came down and passed us. And he looked a very, he looked to be he didn't seem to be a wealthy man. He seemed to have a shabby shirt on him. And I remember, and I often talk to some of the people about this, you had that moment's thought of, what the fuck have we done to this man? You know, but it's quickly passed, you know, but it was a it was like a heart wrenching moment, because I remember it very well. I remember sitting in the dock, and he had a red checked shirt, but he looked shabby, working class, not just unkempt, not dirty, just as if a man who didn't have a lot. And I remember having that sort of moment sitting. Didn't say much of it. Later said, you know, that wasn't a moment that I enjoyed, actually. You know.
When you went out that night, Anthony, to kill someone, I mean, what goes through your head? Do you just see it as an IRA operation? Do you let any sort of emotion come into your head? Do you see this as, I mean, a bid to a closer step to freeing Ireland?
Yeah, I don't think you think in terms of freeing Ireland. You think in terms of the IRA operation, it was something to get done. I had been out all week, not saying doing, or well, I was been out all week, not succeeding at doing what I was trying to do. So Friday night, I had said, right, you know, I'm off tonight, I'm going to do something else. And we had arranged the operation, and there was a problem getting the car. And I said, well, fuck it, I'll get it out of ground. So I came around and put the heavy hand on. And once I get the car, it says I'll do the operation myself. And we went out down to do it. And this is one of the strange things about this, because years later I appeared in court on a supergrass trial. And one of the guys part of the team they were with, who were accused of plotting to kill, was a guy called Norman Rooney. And Norman Rooney came into the witness box and gave evidence that he had never been a target, he'd never been in anything, and nobody had any reason to go for him. So he had no knowledge whatsoever that the IRA were trying to kill him. I'm sitting watching this, I'm just thinking to myself, this is bizarre, because that very night, as we were driving down to take out the doorman, we knew the doorman, we had a reason to believe he was armed, and I'll go into some detail about that later, but we believed the UVF doorman was armed anyway. So we go down, it says, right, we'll take him out. We, on the drive round, first thing, we'd come to another pub, and we had stopped and we had said, right, we'll go and see if there's any of the local UVF about, you know, because like, if you're going to do them, if you get them here, don't miss the opportunity. We went in and we had the arms, but there was four men sitting there, and they were elderly, you know, and I just said, back, out. And we get back out in the car and round. And as we're driving around to the target that we were supposed to be going for, we met Norman Rooney walking past, and I said, fuck, where's Rooney? Get round to get him. But by the time we get round, and he was a target, we knew exactly where we lived. We used to walk past his mother's house, and she was out doing her day with her newer wee cloth, cleaning the front door porch. And we drove around, and Rainey had somehow been in the house or something, so he avoided getting shot. He'd have been as good a target. So we ended up back where we were supposed to be after a circuitous route, and focused on the guy who we, you know, this is a case of thinking. I mean, that looks very much like the main man. Fortunately for us, I suppose, unfortunately for him, he was the main man. And we ended up shooting him dead and injuring three others. And then we drove off and left the car in the markets, got the guns away, and then we headed over to a wash house in Davis Flats and get cleaned them back.
What did you feel like afterwards when you were able to go into your house and sit alone? Did you feel any guilt?
No, I didn't feel guilt. I felt, you know, mixed feelings. You know, you felt disappointed that only one had died. At the same time, saying it's wrong to wish that more would die, you know, because I believed in God at that time and stuff. And, you know, I had these mixed feelings because I was arrested about 5 hours after because of the guy whose car was hijacked had sort of identified me. And I can't say that I felt any guilt. I felt more guilt at wanting more to have died. And the problem was that the only guy who was the target at that bar was the guy who actually died. So it didn't make any sense to want more people dead. But it was like, you know, if you're going to be hung for a sheep, you may as well be, if you're going to be hung for a lamb, you may as well be hung for a sheep. You know, let them all die.
And how did you juggle that with your faith, your belief in God, which you quite obviously was important to you because you mentioned it?
Well, look, there's an old saying by a woman called Annie Lamont that, you know, God's on your side when he hates all the same people you do. It's easy enough, I reckon, Phil. God's just an excuse that people use to justify their badness or the things that they do.
So you were jailed for 25 years. That was appealed. The charges were murder, 3 attempted murders, hijacking, and possession of a weapon. Can you remember the first time you held a gun?
I think it would have been 19. Well, you could hold the British Army guns. They would always let you hold them in the street. I think it was the first time I held an illegal gun. Yeah, it would have been 71.
What age were you then?
14.
Wow. And were you excited as a 14-year-old? Was there any fear? Were you intimidated by it?
No, I wasn't, but I was very excited when I was allowed to fire a Thompson gun at that age.
At that age?
Yeah.
How could a 14-year-old even hold one?
Well, it was on single shot. They were letting me fire it. I was on single shot and I fired 3 shots from it at a barrel.
And I take it that was senior IRA man who would have helped that happen.
Yeah.
And did your parents have any idea you were involved in this?
Well, they knew I was involved in the FENA. They didn't particularly like it. When I was 16, they knew I was heavily involved in the IRA, yeah.
Did they ever try and sit you down and talk you out of it?
Not that I remember. There was a lot of hassle at the time. And I mean, I was on the run, or even, you know, we would have hand-to-hand fights, myself and my father, with the British Army in our garden. You know, one time they arrested him and they says that the officer said to him, it's twice you and that bastard, violent bastard of a son you have has attacked my soldiers and that fucking garden ears. My dad was laughing at it, you know, because I was getting into the house and I was sitting in, like, getting into the kitchen in the living room and I looked across and see my dad sitting in the chair in the corner. He looked at me. A big black hand, black gloved hand around my throat, pulled me out. And by the time when he took the hand off, I chinned him and with a fit. And my dad came out and he was a heavy digger, so he put him down. And then the chiefs came up and they said, right, you have to reach an agreement here. Has to be searched. So I said, fine. My dad says, you're fine to be searched. I said, yeah. But when I was getting searched, your mom kicked me. So it started all off again. I beat him. And the best time of crowd at Gillard, and the Brits were really, they were getting nervous. So they backed off. And, you know, down in an ornate, I came running into the house and turning behind me. And I said, hey, running through. And I'm saying, divert the bastards as I was getting out. And they come in, the Brit said, where is he? And my dad says, up the stairs. And they come up the stairs, and I bet him over the walls and away, and he come down and says, where? He's not up the stairs. And my dad says, I don't give a fuck where he is. You know, so they arrested him and war fights and stuff.
So you were jailed in 19, you were, sorry, you were sentenced in 1977.
Yeah.
And the blanket protest had already started because you were on remand from 1976.
The blanket protest started in September 76 with Kieran Nugent. It was the 14th of September, but I had special category status, political status, so I went to the cages of Long Kish Rall and the Blacks. And after an allegation that that I had tried to escape on the June, I went on to the blanket. I was in the boards as a punishing black for about 2 weeks, and then the NAO sent me up on the 12th of July of all days to the blankets. They divested me of my political status, my special category status, so I had to go on the blanket protest.
You had to go on. Was there no choice?
Well, the choice was limited, but I had to go on because, you know, for me, there was no choice. I wasn't going anywhere else. I mean, the notion of not getting on the blanket protest simply seemed abhorrent to me. So, yeah, there was nowhere else to go.
Did you know how hard it was going to be? Because I have spoken to former IRA men who were involved, and I mean, it sounds horrendous.
Well, I didn't know how hard it was going to be. I didn't think it was going to be as long. But I mean, I came on it. What I was surprised at the first day with coming on it was the screws, Tommy Keenan, a guy called Tommy Keenan, and another guy called Fred Stanton. And they're actually very polite, because I was expecting a beating. Nothing, they were polite, brought down the wing, and I was bracing myself the whole time because I says, I'm afraid I'll vomit. I got in the cell, there was absolutely no smell or anything, that the canned food, all the things would hurt, so... and then the governor came round and I was in Selby again. As soon as the governor came round to adjudicate, I was only on the wing about an hour, half an hour. He started saying, this is what you're doing. He's banging a piss pot and hooting and tooting in the governor's face and screaming at him. And I was supposed to do it too, but I just stood there saying it because this was madness to me. And I knew it sooner or later we'd get into it, but at the moment it was just seemed crazy. And the governor was a guy called Chambers, and he leaned over and whispered in my ear. He says, you know, they need to shout at me or they can make himself heard. But because I wasn't banging, I could hear him. And he says, if you don't leave this, you'll end up as mad as him. And I said to myself, maybe the governor's right. But mad, so be it.
What was the toughest part of it all, Anthony?
Well, I mean, one of the worst parts was the anticipation of violence. Because they were violent, and they were violent every day against somebody. You know, you could go whole days, weeks, without anything happening in your wing. But they were violent. There's always some report comeback of violence or somebody getting bit, and quite often it was in your wing. Myself and a guy called Christopher McKnight got a very bad beating in 1978, September 1970, at Forced Wyches. The doctor came in and said we were too dirty, so we had to be washed to stop the spread of disease, some excuse. Mm-hmm. And the beating they gave us was really bad.
And this is the prison guards, the riot squad.
Not the riot squad, prison guards. And I met them later, many, many years later. it was strange because in the different circumstances, you know, they were different guys. You know, now one of them wasn't, because and he ended up getting killed by the IRA in 1988, a guy called Brian Armour. And I had written a piece about Brian Armour, you know, saying like, I mean, had I have been there, just threw a blanket over him and sort of walked on, different sort of victory of the blanket man, the passivity of the blanket protest over his violence. And his daughter wrote to me, and she said, this is horrible what you've said about my daddy. My daddy was a good man. So I wrote back to her and I said, look, I don't understand how you feel, but I had a different experience to your father. And, she says maybe he was that way because of circumstances. And we had this very pleasant exchange. And then the final email, she said that she was very, very nice at the end. She says, don't be saying anything bad about my daddy again. I laughed, you know. And I mean, from her point of view, I'm sure Brian Armour was a very good father. I'm sure he was a loving husband. I'm sure his kids loved him. But I had a different experience of Brian. I remember, funny enough, I know a guy who's a former blanket man who still goes up to Brian's grave and talks to Brian. And he says it would be free, Brian, it wasn't worth it, you know. I don't think I'd.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
I don't know why I said them before. I woke up and I remember when we were drunk, I said we'll go up and piss in his grave, you know, but it's all nonsense. There's no chance of me ever pissing in his grave. But and funny enough, like some of the more violent ones, I remember years later, they come on, one of them come on the wing, and we were in total charge on the wing at this time. And he says to them, "Do you want a cup of coffee, Billy?" He says, "I'll take your cup." He says, "Do you want something to eat, babe?" He says, "Have you a Mars bar?" So I got him a Mars bar, give him his tea, his coffee, and his Mars bar, and went on the way. You know, like I sort of said, what happened, happened, you know.
So how would you describe those 3 years for you? Is it something that you're proud of doing? Is it something, I mean, obviously you would have wanted to avoid it if you could. What way do you look back on it?
Well, I look back on it as a major spur to intellectual and the development, because while I spoke to you earlier about the violence you've been present, the biggest challenge of Blanket was the tedium, the soul-destroying boredom. And you never wanted it to be punctuated by violence. Well, it was soul destroying. And there was a Bible, the only thing that you had to read from, I mean, they used to give you some religious magazines, and there were, I mean, the likes of Reality was good because the philosophical one, I mean, it was there, first became familiar with the views of Camus and Sartre. And then there was one by a guy called Louis Watt about communism and religion, and I became very familiar with some of the concepts and ideas in it. And But all that had gone by February 79, so you had a Bible. But I do remember one time a board of visitors woman coming in and saying, "Any requests?" She's a pompous old bastard. So I said, "Suppose some reading material wouldn't go amiss." And she said, "Use the good book." I said, "Tell you what, Mrs., I'll never fucking read it. I'll use it." I says, "Make good cigarette roll ups and I'll keep my feet warm during the fucking winter. I will use it as toilet roll. The fuck will I ever read it?" And I never did. I simply point blank refused to read the fucking thing from my point on. We used to say it's good, but the Bible is very good for the soul. Because what I used to do, and I'm sure everybody else did it during the winter, was when the people wanted to talk at the window, right? You could stand on the floor, but the floor was too cold. And we were naked. All we had was a blanket. And so, or you could stand on the pipes, but the pipes were too warm. So you put your Bible on the floor. And you stand in the Bible. And so the Bible, the coldness of the floor didn't get through the Bible.
Wow.
And so that was my view of the Bible.
And that's what you meant by warming your feet?
Well, it says the Bible's good for your soul, the soul of your feet.
Did you feel like you were ever going to get out of prison? You were going through all these phases. I mean, you were going through the blanket, then it came onto the hunger strikes. Did it feel never ending?
No, we always felt there'd be a future.
right?
You know, we always felt, this is the strange thing about the hunger strikes, we always felt that I always felt there would be a future. I had volunteered for the hunger strikes, and Bec McFarland had said to me, you know, you're in a position like myself, you are in for what's called a sectarian killing, and you'll not, you know, they're not the sort of people that we want on the hunger strikes. That's what they want, because Bec, that's for the reason Bec was elite. It didn't make a lot of sense at that time. At that time, the IRA were denying but involved in sectarian killings, and the only person convicted of a killing that was on the hunger strike was Frank Hughes. And Frank Hughes had, he'd been involved in killing the SAS man, a paratrooper. So that was, you know, what the IRA could have considered as a pretty good kill. Our killings, people like, you mean, were getting killed at bars, or even though they're members of UVF, and it was hard to put that across.
So paramilitaries were seen, you know, killing other paramilitaries was seen as sectarian killings, but not the security forces?
No, the problem was that wasn't admitted until later, that Kenneth Lenham was a member of the UVF.
Okay.
We had known it. I remember the cops saying in the barracks, your intelligence is as good as ours. But it wasn't put down. It was just put down as a drive-by killing. So the IRA would have had this view about hunger strikes. I mean, when and Haynes said, I'm obviously quite glad that Bec made that decision, because the more you think about it, you know, well, I mean, you just wonder, could I have done it? Could I have gone through it? I'm not so sure. And I know others who was in the cell with people like Lawrence McKeown. You know, I was very annoyed one time when it was said that the people whose families signed them off the hunger strike did it with a collaboration of hunger strikers, you know, and that therefore people like, it was implicit that people like Lawrence McKeown weren't going to go through with it. Total nonsense. I was in the Lawrence, I knew Lawrence, you know. Lawrence was in for, I'm quite glad that he lived, and I'm quite glad that his mother intervened when I look back, but Lawrence McKeown was for dying on that hunger strike, you know, and I mean, remarkable bravery, remarkable courage. I'm glad he survived. And at the time, I had convinced myself that I took it to it, but when I look back, and maybe I'm thinking from the benefit of hindsight, I'm not so sure it should. Whereas today, you know, I don't worry about death. I mean, as I say, I'm the only one wouldn't know I'm dead. I don't think death, and but dying's always something to fear, the manner of dying, but being dead, no, it's just like being like operating on, you know. Like best memories of my life are things I don't remember, such as the when you're under anesthetic and operation, it's great. And then you're waking up and say, what the fuck?
Did you know Bobby Sands well?
Didn't know him well, but knew him. Had met him one time in the visits. We went down one time for a visit, an ecclesiastical visit, they called him. So it was a way to get down to meet people from the Irish Blacks in time and take the messages back. So we're in there, myself, Sid Walsh, Sina Walsh, Bobby Sands, and some others from Twinburg. So we're sitting in a 2-hour conversation with Bobby and Sid and the priests. Sid Walsh, a guy who I never particularly got on with, you know, but again, when you look back at his form, you know, massive, massive commitment. You know, this is a guy who got out of jail twice. And on the second time he got out, he had the chance of a cushy number, but he didn't. He put the gloves back on, married man, and back in the jail. Yeah, like whatever disagreements you have with people, you have to admire them people. You know, and I certainly admired him. He was there that day. And the strange thing is, the night of the hunger strike, the first hunger strike ended, which was the 18th of December, 1980, the van pulled up in the yard, Bobby. Next thing, somebody gets out, we couldn't make out who it was. Next thing, our cell opened, and Bobby Sands come in. He's wearing a prison uniform. Myself and Lawrence were in the third day or the fourth day of the hunger strike, because we had the whole team had been brought on at the end of the 1981. And he came in and he explained this, that the hunger strike was over, the boys were in a bad way, and they're going to ask the cardinal to make a statement. But he came into our cell by mistake. He thought he was going to Pat McGeown's cell, because Pat McGeown was on our wing, and he was the Black OC, and the Screws were letting Bobby get around the Blacks to brief the Black OCs, but they mixed Pat McGeown's name up with Lawrence McGeown, and they put him on with Wilson. So Bobby went out, and Lawrence said to me, somebody, Bobby says, the lads in the bar, I said, the hunger strike's over, Lawrence. He's only after telling us over. He says, no, he didn't say that. I says, he did. He says, no. He said the lads in a bad way. I says, in a bad way. They're off the hunger strike. So he says, no. And it was funny. So I said, well, look, we'll wait and Pat. And the next thing, Pat announced it. I don't know how. Lorne, you know, whatever way, talking in the cell. Lawrence just didn't pick up on it. I think he was amazed about as shocked as I was coming into the cell. I always remember that.
You had said previously that you believed that when Bobby Sands was elected to Parliament for Fermanagh and South Tyrone, that would have been the end of the hunger strikes.
Well, that's a conclusion I came to many years later. I didn't at the time. When I reflected on it long after, I felt that that was the time to end it. But I do remember not feeling for a minute that we should end it then. And when Lawrence, strangely enough, I always remember when Lawrence McCune's Muller took him off it, I had this punchy hour moment. Punchy hour, you know, Lawrence has lived, Lawrence has survived. Yet, bizarrely, agreeing with the continuation of hunger strike. I mean, we'd lost the plot. I think all the evidences are that they overruled the jail leadership who wanted to end it. Now, at the time, I could say, right, you know, had they have admitted this when O'Rourke came out and made his allegations, I think most of us could have said, nah, well, I mean, the times where we're in it, you know, I mean, they were trying to get a better deal for the hunger strikers, and they made a mistake. And, you know, we'd have been very forgiven because nobody wants to be accused. You don't want to accuse anybody just for the sake of accusing them. And the lies that they come out with, the attempts to smear, the labelling of people, the labelling of the Boston College Project as the work of informers, calling me, not that I care, Dr. Anthony McIntyre. I mean, Donnie Morrison and those people fronted a very vicious campaign against me and the others, and I mean, particularly against Rich LaRaw. And I've taken the view that has led me to believe that there was no innocent explanation, otherwise they would have given one. They just lied out of both sides of their mouths at the same time. And I mean, it is a very sad outcome. And I know Lawrence dissents and people, I mean, other very, very courageous people like Pat Sheehan, who were in hunger strike, also dissent from that view. But I just don't think that the evidence supports them. And Bick McFarlane, I mean, Bick McFarlane is one of the people that I met in the prison from early on, and I've always had a tremendous admiration for Brenton. And I don't share the hostility towards him, but many share as a result of the hunger strike and the way Richard O'Raw has claimed it ended, and Richard's right on how it ended. And he thinks that Bick should have done more. But I think at that time, Brenton McFarlane was a brilliant leader, but and I'm saying, I mean, therefore the grace of whatever go I, I'm not sure I would have made a different decision in his position. I think his focus was on not just the jail but the IRA, and I think he had a lot of trust in Adams. I would like Brenton just to, I mean, think back and reflect on it and come out and state exactly what happened. But has he gone down in my estimation? No, he has not. And he's one of the people that I most admire.
1992 was when you left prison?
Yeah, December the 18th.
What was the feeling leaving the Hitchblocks that day?
It wasn't the Hitchblocks I left. We were working out from McGabry for 3 months. Right. So you were well out, really, by that time. The last day I spent under a prison roof would have been the 17th of December, and the next day I came out late because the prison dentist had to do something, give me a filling or something, and then they got me a taxi down and into Belfast to my work, and it just felt good to have it over with. Felt good.
Was it hard adjusting to normal life?
No. Hugh Feeney once said to me in the jail, it's never hard. He says, it's hard adjusting to the prison when you can back off paroles. He says, we're just, when we go out there, we're like ducks in water. I thought it was great. You know, I remember going out and the first time it was absolutely brilliant, you know, in 3 days trying to pack everything in. And then going back in and the place looked so cramped and small and dark, and I felt awful depressed in the place, you know. So getting used to outside isn't the problem. It's getting used to inside. Although I think in some ways it has to have affected us in terms of emotional intelligence and emotional maturity and stuff, you know, that maybe you're just not equipped to handle the world if you had the experience of being outside. We live different lives. A guy once asked me, like, you lost an awful lot of your life, and I said I didn't. It was just life lived differently.
When you came out, what was the thing that you wanted to do the most? Was it a career? Was it, again, focusing on the Republican movement?
Yeah, I think that the focusing on the movement, getting back into the movement and being part of it, because we've been so shaped by what had happened and so shaped by the hunger strike, that, yeah, I wanted to be a full-time activist within the movement.
And were you prepared to go back to prison?
Yeah, I'm always prepared to go back to prison. I'm even prepared to go back to prison today rather than give over one sliver of detail to the cops about Boston College or anything. So, and was I prepared to go back to prison? Yeah, I was prepared to go back to prison.
But
if you ask me, when I tell you that I'm prepared to go back to prison today, would I go back to prison today for the IRA armed struggle? Would I fuck, to put it very, very, in the most unparliamentary of language?
You left in 1998 when the Good Friday Agreement was signed.
Yeah.
Why?
Well, I felt that the Good Friday Agreement was a complete inversion of everything that we had stood for and everything that we had argued for. And I felt that there was nothing in the Good Friday Agreement. I've been predicting this from before the Downing Street Declaration, really, and after the Downing Street Declaration, when it was more or less begun writing publicly in 1983, that, you know, there was nothing in it. I had argued, look, everybody has the right to celebrate Christmas, but not the turkeys. There's no point in turkeys celebrating Christmas. They get the chap. Republicanism was getting the chap here. And, you know, to pretend that, the Good Friday Agreement was something. I mean, and this is the reality. We had to pretend that the Good Friday Agreement was something other than it was. The Good Friday Agreement was the total rejection, political and ethical, of the IRA's armed struggle. And I had said, fine, if that's the way they want to go, but I'm not celebrating it, and I think it's wrong, and I think we should never sign up for it. Not that I thought we should go back to war, but I felt that, you know, why should Republicans even be part of this? Because you were just, if you look at Sinn Féin today, I don't see a lot of difference between them and the rest of them. Either they remain me of all the politicians that we always oppose. And if you want to kill people, take people's legs, you have to at least be serious. And can the Good Friday Agreement justify one single death between the Sunningdale Agreement and the Good Friday Agreement? 24 years of war for what? Horrific. That anybody should die for that.
Do you still feel that way about the Good Friday Agreement?
I do. I'm not saying the Good Friday Agreement's a bad agreement. The Good Friday Agreement in a sort of a divided society with where there is no overall way of achieving Republican goals. And a sort of in a so-called liberal democratic society, the Good Friday Agreement is probably the natural outcome, the obvious outcome to end it. And, you know, I have no problems with the likes of the SDLP signing up to the Good Friday Agreement and other people, the Alliance and all. That is a manifestation of their politics. That is how they have conducted their political lives. I mean, John Hume, Alex Atwood, all those people who were in the SDLP and Mark Durkin, they have every reason to argue for the Good Friday Agreement. Because that philosophy underpinning the Great Friday Agreement was always argued by them anyway, and argued against us by them when we were waging our campaign. And for us to turn around and say, well, the Good Friday Agreement's a good agreement, it's good for everybody but the Turkish. And we're very much the Turkish. So I've always been a critic and a dissenter from the Good Friday Agreement. And I think that, you know, when they talk about consent means nothing unless you have the right to dissent. Because if you freely consent, then you can freely withdraw your consent. And I reserve the right to dissent from the Good Friday Agreement, seeing nothing in it from a Republican perspective. But would I oppose it violently? Not in the slightest. And I don't endorse anybody that opposes it violently. And the Good Friday Agreement is much better in our armed struggle. I just don't. I think it's just a sort of a fiction manufactured. I mean, our support for it anyway was a fiction manufactured to cover the fact that the IRA had failed.
Tell me about the Boston Tips, or what has become known as the Boston Tips, because in 2001 you became involved in an oral history project with a US university, Boston College. And this is now, would you say, Anthony, synonymous with you?
Well, unfortunately, it is synonymous with me. I'm probably remembered more for the Boston Tips than I'm remembered for anything else. I think it in some ways has come to defend me when I'd rather be defamed in other ways. Most people who think of the name Anthony McIntyre probably think that's a tosser that did get involved in that Boston College project. Look, the Boston College project has come to defend me. I was responsible for the interviews in the Boston College project, and Ed Maloney was my project manager, and we did what we thought was a good piece of work. I am of the view that that sort of truth recovery is necessary. When I look at what prosecutions have recovered and what courts have recovered, I'm saying, well, I haven't really recovered that much. I think there's more truth to be recovered through Boston College tape projects. And it's interesting because when Owen Paterson was Secretary of State and the Brenton Hughes book was published by Ed, well, not the Brenton Hughes book as such, but the Voices from the Grave, Owen Paterson said that a template for truth recovery could be the Boston College project template. And a month later, there's a subpoena coming through trying to sabotage it. So,
basically, yeah. For anyone who doesn't know about the Boston Tips and the Oral History Project, you were one of two researchers who was carrying out interviews with former paramilitaries as part of this college project, and that information, those interviews, wouldn't be used until after those paramilitaries passed away.
Well, that's true. I carried out the Republican interviews. Wilson MacArthur carried out the Loyalist interviews. The undertakings given were that the contents of their interviews would not be made public until they had passed away, or if they give consent. Boston did come at us one time and asked them to give their consent to do it earlier, and we wouldn't go for that. But, I mean, it was with their consent. And in one case, interviewee Z, who's accused of trying to bring down Gerry Adams, had actually written into his, which Boston College seemed to have lost, that there would be no release of his tapes until 30 years after both him and his partner were dead, which meant by the time that had happened, there was not going to be current affairs. I mean, and Gerry Adams would not have been, unless he lives, he's 120, wouldn't have been arrested, wouldn't have been subject to the public scrutiny.
When this first, the issues with this project started to arise, I mean, it must have been your worst nightmare as a Republican.
It was my worst nightmare as an individual. It was the most depressing experience of my entire life, and I've had quite a few of them. And it was terrible. It was that you know, you had dropped the ball, you felt you had dropped the ball, and somebody else had it and you couldn't get it back. And because you couldn't get it back, all those people's fates, futures, state of mind, everything was now out of your hands. And even though you felt that you were the catalyst for it, that you had some, you felt awful guilt. I felt awful guilt about it, about, you know, all these people who would be facing arrest, who would be facing possible imprisonment. Yeah, wasn't nice. I mean, the worst thing that can happen to a researcher is if they fail to protect the their sources. I mean, it's terrible, terrible, terrible. And you know, all the things that I was quite prepared to go to jail. I would have sat in jail until I died, rather than ever have them compromised. But as I say, the ball had been dropped, and there was nothing I could do. But at that point, all of them fed it and take the case to court and frustrate them at every turn.
So can you recall the moment that you were told that the PSNI was seeking to retrieve this information? Did you just brush it off, like, oh, well, they're just at their work, it's not going anywhere?
Did I? Fuck, I remembered right away. I came home from work and my wife had said to me, Ed needs to talk to you. And I said, what's up? He says, he needs to talk to you, it's very important. And I got on to him right away, and he had explained to me, and I remember saying to him, well, one of the first things that struck me, that they issued a subpoena, said to me, if they issued one, it means that they can't issue one. If they can't issue one, it means that could all of us issue one. How the fuck did we not get on top of this? How did we not work this out? And I mean, we've come to the conclusion the reason we didn't work it out is because boss and colleagues failed in their duty of candor.
So that's where it went wrong then?
Well, that's from my view where it went wrong. Now, for long enough, it was hard for us to get that argument across, but I think Beth McMurtry and the Times for Higher, the sort of education, some Chronicle for Higher Education, Beth McMurtry managed to get that out in a very comprehensive article. And then as time went on, writers like Patrick Rudd and Keith managed to reinforce it. And it's just, it's come round now to, I think there's a consensus that Boston messed up. Now, that's not the result of us of culpability, because we messed up too. We you know, things like this can happen. We should have applied due diligence in every aspect. But we, at the time, nobody felt that there would be prosecutions. We were told that the loyalists were told this as well, that there was no chance of there being prosecutions. Wilson MacArthur was told there wouldn't even be a sneak peek at this. And unlike the IRA, it's my understanding, the IRA who didn't know about this project, the UVF leadership met with Boston College to discuss it, and they signed off on it. So it wasn't carried out without their knowledge, and they weren't signing off on anything unless they're absolutely certain that there would be no prosecutions. So I think Boston did and let us down, and then Boston tried to throw us to the wolves and started to blame us. And the people like Jack Dunn, their spokesperson, coming out and making some ridiculous assertions, dishonest assertions, and his whole thrust was to protect the institution. Over time, I think, and particularly the work of Ted Paulus and John Loman added to the other work, and this was an academic work, but added to the works I mentioned earlier, they put the college in the frame properly for abdicating this responsibility and duty of care.
So correct me if I'm wrong, Anthony. The interview that really kick-started the whole PSNI process to obtain those tips was a newspaper interview with Dolores Price, who, an IRA bomber who in 1973 was jailed for an attack on the Old Bailey. You carried that interview with Dolores for the Boston College?
I did interview Dolores was the godmother of my son. I had a very good friendship with her. a very good relationship with her. We were very close, and I conducted that series of interviews with the Irish Press.
So, am I right in saying that no one really knew about the Boston College oral history project until that interview with Dolores Price?
No, no, I'm trying to remember, but the book about Brenton Hughes.
Yes.
What if alerted, and I'm just trying to remember which came first, and I think it was the book.
Brendan, and again, Brendan, a very good friend of yours, yeah. Was he happy to take part in the project?
Well, he was delighted mm-hmm. to take part in the project. See, one of the reasons that the book came out is Brendan wanted to have his interviews released and mm-hmm. the story out early. Mm-hmm. I had to persuade him that this would jeopardize the whole project, but I gave him an undertaking that when the time came and it was safe to put it out, we would put it out. And then Brendan's brother came here and he says, I know you or Ed Maloney have tapes. And I says, I can't really discuss it with you, Terry. And he says, well, look, I'm going to publish what I have. But I have been told that from the family, because Brendan had told, I think, his sister, that me and Ed had tapes. So there was an obligation I felt that I made an undertaking to Brendan that we would publish. So we did. Well, Ed did, and I had no criticisms of him for it.
Was Dolores happy to do the interview, sit down and speak to you and tell what she believed to be her story?
Well, she was. She was very happy. But before it started, I spoke to Dolores. I briefed her and I told her what we were doing. And then we had an off-the-record discussion. And she was talking about the type of things that she would be discussing, because you want to get your questions ready. You want to prepare yourself for discussion. And she told me the Jean McConville story. So I said to her, Dolores, it'd be great to get this story. It's a brilliant story. Would love to have it for the Boston College project. But I said, I have a duty of courtesy and a duty of candor, and I have to, I'm not saying I said it in those words, but I did explain to her that, it's okay for you to reveal all this to us, but you have to be sure in your own mind that this is what you want to do, because once you're dead, you'll be safe from any fallout. I said, but your children may carry the mark of Cain, because the killing of Jean McConville is such an obnoxious event. And she thought about it and came back and said to me that she wouldn't mention it. And she didn't to me. She didn't mention Jean McConville and her I didn't deal in the interviews. And when I made an affidavit to the court, telling the court that I didn't interview Dolores about Jean McConville.
For anyone who doesn't know Jean McConville's story, she is a mother of 10 who was abducted and murdered by the IRA and disappeared.
I mean, she was furious over the newspaper. She was furious over the Irish News.
Why?
Because she thinks that she was abused and manipulated, and the family took that view.
But she did willingly share that information about Jean McConville.
Well, she did, and when I say that she felt let down, badly let down by the Irish News, because she didn't. I'm not sure she wanted to share it with the Irish News as such, and she later claimed that she felt manipulated into it.
So you've spent the last, best part of 20 years going through not only the project, but the court proceedings. And the worst thing about it is that you actually took part. You were interviewed for this. So do you feel guilty for those that trusted you, Anthony? But you've also kind of landed yourself in it, or could have landed yourself in it with some
I'm pretty indifferent to that. I'm philosophical about that. Yeah, it's a nuisance, but I think it was one of the factors that enhanced the trust, more trust in me, that when it did, you know, when it did hit the fan, the proverbial hit the fan, the attitude of people who I had interviewed was, well, there's owner in there. You didn't set us up. I think Ed took a lot of flack, but then it was easy to give Ed flack because he was removed. He hadn't been part of the IRA, and people, you know, I mean, people are looking around sometimes for a scapegoat, you know. I think it was easy for someone to kick Ed. I think Ed has sort of questions to answer, yeah, in relation to it. We all have. But this has to be said about Ed. Had Ed not made two crucial interventions when he did, the whole project would have been with the Boston and College would have handed the whole lad over. That it's still going on and that it was delayed and that they got so very little of it as a result of the interventions that Ed Maloney made. The first one was telling the New York Times what Boston College were about to do and what is happening, and Boston College didn't want it out. And the second one was going for her own legal counsel. They were two crucial interventions mm-hmm. that stopped us. They really stopped the PSNI in their tracks.
So, I mean, at present, we have seen one trial where no charges came out of that at all, no convictions. That was Ivor Bell.
Found not guilty.
And then we also have loyalist Winky Ray, who is accused of the murder of two Catholic workmen and the attempted murder of others. And that's ongoing. Is there anything else that could come down the line, Anthony, do you believe?
Well, I can't comment on that, and the reason I can't comment on that is I can't leave myself horses to fortune. Mm-hmm. I don't want to go into any detail about anything else. I think at the moment it looks unlikely. I mean, you've got all the amnesty proposals coming through. The British are going to do their usual, and not for good reason. I agree, funny enough, and always have, with the drop in the prosecutions. I set it off to the Savile inquiry. I can't see any benefit, any advantage in prosecutions. I think the prosecutions raise the bar for truth so high that the strategy of prosecutions is that your overall goal is to achieve as few successful outcomes as possible, yet you keep everybody away from revealing the truth about what happened because they are afraid of prosecution.
Your family were subjected to an unbelievable amount of harassment and abuse, and in fact, your neighbour's house got smeared in excrement mm-hmm. during this.
Well, we were subjected to an enormous amount of abuse, intimidation, threats. Smearing graffiti up and down the Falls Road, calling us touts and alienation.
Was it tough?
Probably. I mean, it was. You had to deal with it down here. It'd have been much tougher had I been living in Belfast.
Yeah, because you lived in Drogheda now. You've been here many years. You're happy.
Yeah. Well, I'm happy to live in Drogheda.
You don't miss Belfast at all?
Not in the slightest.
Why?
I from the day I came down to Drogheda, I don't miss it. I don't miss the village mentality, the narrow-mindedness. I remember one time my daughter came in and she told me that Protestants are bad. She was six at the time. And she says, well, why are they bad? And she says, her wee friend in the street had told her they were bad. And I says, okay. I said, why are they bad? She says, well, they shoot you. And I says, okay. So next day, I took her on a bus and I went down to Davy Adams's house. Davy Adams was a loyalist, and me and him sat, a loyalist, a friend of mine, me and him sat having this good long talk. And for the 3 hours we were there, chewing the fat, Davy's mother in law played with my daughter, talked to her. So on the bus back home, I says, did you like the woman? She said, yeah, I did like the woman. I says, and she good, yeah. I said, she didn't shoot you. Oh, why? I said, because she's a Protestant. So Protestants don't actually shoot you. And I thought that was a worthwhile experience. But when we were down here a number of years, I wrote a piece about that at the time, but she went down here a number of years and she came in one day and she says, "What's a Protestant?" And I said, "That's a benefit of living in Dragula." She just forgot.
She forgot what a Protestant was.
So it was quite good. I mean, down here, she means you don't know what anybody is. Yeah. Who knows or cares? And then for people like me, I remember one day a guy from the north says, "See him you're working with, he's a prod." I said, "Fuck the I care what he is. He fucking can be a Jew or a Muslim, fucking skin of my nose." And you just don't know, and it's not how you relate to people. I have no religion, and I don't relate to other people by their religion, unless they're religious maniacs trying to sort of ban abortions and tell me that the earth is 6,000 years old. And strangely enough, I mean, there's a guy that would come here occasionally to meet him and go for breakfast. He lives abroad, but he's a free Presbyterian pastor. I'd be very friendly with him.
Isn't that great? I mean, you seem happy. You seem happy to be, I mean, away from the thing that you were once so passionate about that it turned you into a killer.
Well, yeah, that's, I mean, I'm, you see, I don't believe that I have the right to kill anybody. And when I look back, I don't believe that I had ever the right to kill anybody. I mean, the notion, it strikes me as so arrogant that I can go around saying to people, "Well, I have the right to kill you." What gives me the right to kill anybody? All I can explain are the circumstances in which it happened and offer mitigation. But as for justification, I don't get into it. I think there's an awful arrogance about this. And then the things that you valued then, you have different values now. I mean, I think the thing that I most retained from republicanism, even though I wouldn't have been sort of an activist on it, or I mean, there were five isms in republicanism. One of them was secularism. And that's the one that interests me most. I mean, the separatism, the socialism, the nationalism, the non-sectarianism, you know. The thing of the Machiavellian, I mean, I'm non-sectarian anyway, my temperament and my outlook is non-sectarian. Yeah, I agree with socialism. Nationalism, I'm a fair about. I'm one of them people that actually think that there's value in having one government in the world to solve the global problems, given the global situation that we live in. I agree with the former Hugo Morris leader on this, who was the president of Uruguay, I think Pepe, that you know, a world government is probably the way to go. I know there's major difficulties with it, so it's only a concept. And how can you ever implement? I mean, there's so many divides and nation states and stuff, and nation states still many ways how we conduct international relations. But so I'm not too keen on nationalism, but secularism is the one that I would be pretty active in. You know, I'm in the Humanist Association, I'm in the Atheist Ireland. I would write about the end of life. One of the campaigns that I sort of value is the end of life. End of life Ireland, because I just simply, you know, I want to die the way I want to die. I don't want to die. I'm not going to die the way the basic wants me to die. Basic would go fuck himself. Same with abortion. I support the right of every pregnant basic not to have abortion, but my name will it be. So secularism was probably the one thing that I retained from it all.
One thing I wanted to ask you about to see if your opinion had changed was in 2004 when you caused some controversy with interviewing the then PSNI Chief Constable Hugh Orde. So you could question him from a radical Republican perspective. And you said at the time, "The war is over and the Brits won. When I met Hugh Orde, I was meeting the head of a victorious police force. He was meeting a former member of a defeated army. And you said at the time that you could never support the PSNI and you would never allow your children to join it. Do you still feel that way about the PSNI?"
Oh, very much so. I mean, if anything, the Boston College thing has since hardened my attitude towards the PSNI. But the PSNI, I mean, I quite like Hugh Orde. You know, when Heyward was getting criticised for his affair, and he fathered a child, and I was asked by one of the papers, well, what do you think? And the unionists were up shouting all about what a rascal he was. And my view was, if you think of things that's happened, but what chief constables have done here, and other chief constables, and the war crimes and stuff that they've been guilty of, what's Heyward guilty of? Fathering a child? It's natural slang in the word. Heyward any day of the week. I like Heyward. I'm surprised, pleasantly surprised that you said cause controversy. I didn't know there was that much interest in it.
A few newspaper articles.
Heyward was a good interviewer, and that he Carrie arranged the interview, and we both interviewed him. And Carrie's my wife, and that she, me and her, Carrie conducted that interview. And I always remember it because on the way to it, she took a pregnancy test and discovered that she was pregnant. So Heyward was the first person we told that Carrie was pregnant. We're running.
Oh my goodness. Well, you'll never forget that interview in more ways than one. Last question, Anthony. And I mean, you've answered every question I've put to you. The last one is Operation Canova. What's your initial feelings on what the outcome will be there? Because I know you knew Freddie Scapatici. John Boucher, who's the lead detective, has said he's had calls with MI5. There's 12,000 documents have been obtained, 1,000 statements. What do you think is going to come out of it, or is it going to
I don't think much is going to come out of it. I think we might get a lot of truth. I don't think we're going to get terms of prosecutions. And I think I do think John Boucher approached this with courage and integrity. It's my understanding that when John Boucher took on this job, he was told, "You're mad. Don't go near it." I believe that only one person sort of supported him, which was John Stevens. I believe that my understanding is that Sir John Stevens said to him, "If you've got the cojones, go for it." He certainly had, and I think he has tried and will try to do his best. But I still revert back to what Barry McCreary said. And it's often said that this is a Barry McCreary push thing, that this is great to get a solicitor in who into the prosecution service and the evidence of how things can progress. I don't think Barry McCreary was ever behind that. I don't think he was a main impetus. I think the type of thinking that was going on within the PSNI is sort of reflected in George Hamilton, was probably a greater impetus in getting this sorted. And pushing for Scapatici to be investigated. Now, Barry McCreary did say the people who have the greatest thing to fear from this are those IRA leaders who sanctioned those the deaths of people. So while it's sold publicly as an investigation of the British, I think it's really an investigation of the IRA as well. And that there's a lot of people with a lot to fear from this, because I think that John Boucher will open a can of rats rather than a can of worms.
Very, very interesting. Anthony, thank you again for speaking to me for today's podcast. It's been a pleasure.
On a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, everyone. Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.